conversation between Carl Erskine and Walter Langford is being taped in Carl's office in the First National Bank of Anderson, Indiana, on May 8th, 1987. Carl, tell me, when you signed your first contract in pro ball, and what'd you do, where'd you go in the minors?
Okay. I was born and raised right here in Anderson, Indiana, and was scouted in high school. In those days, there was no draft, so the Major League scouts could talk to a player who, in fact, they started talking to me from the Cubs when I was a sophomore in high school. Well, when I graduated from high school, I would have gone into some, hopefully, pro ball, but I was drafted in the Navy. Had to spend a little over a year, and as soon as I got out of the Navy, the Dodgers signed me. Mr. Rickey personally signed me. And gave me a bonus, which was unheard of by baseball standards in those days, particularly for Mr. Rickey, who wasn't known to
throw
money around. And the irony of the whole thing was, Boston, while I was in the Navy, tried to sign me Billy Southworth. I used to throw batting practice up there, and Billy Southworth was there and liked me. And that's ironic. I see his name right here. On the open page.
Right.
But so they put heat on me. The Dodgers had scouted me in high school and had me to come to New York as a high school graduate and work out. So they had their hooks in me pretty well. I wanted to play for the Dodgers.
Yeah.
So I called the Dodgers and said the Braves were putting heat on me. Mr. Rickey sent for my parents to come to Boston during the All-Star game in 46 and signed me in the Kenmore Hotel. I was 19, and we went up to his suite, and Mr. Rickey signed me and gave me a bonus in order to beat the Braves, who had offered me a $2,500 bonus. Mr. Rickey gave me
$3,500.
Oh, boy. And then the Braves blew the whistle on the Dodgers for signing me as a serviceman. And I had been discharged in the few weeks following that signing and had gone to Danville, Illinois in the 3I League to finish the season. Got there in late July. By the end of that season, I played a month and a half. Happy Chandler called me in his office in Cincinnati, the commissioner of baseball at that time, and said the Dodgers violated the directive that by signing me as a serviceman, so he was declaring me a free agent. And so in the ensuing days, although I had offers then from the Red Sox, the Braves, the Phillies, the Cubs, I wanted to re-sign with the Dodgers. So although I had offers of up to $10,000, which is amazing amount of money in those days, I said to the Dodgers scout, Stan Fiesel, who was lived in Indianapolis and scouted me all through high school, I said, Mr. Fiesel, if the Dodgers will give me an additional $5,000, the 35 I already have, and they'll give me an additional $5,000, I'll re-sign with the Dodgers. That's what I did. Now, don't ask me why I took less money than I could have gotten.
A lot of people do that.
I wanted to play for the Dodgers, and it was just a break for me to get to negotiate a second time.
Yeah.
Dizzy Dean, years later, interviewing me, said, I don't believe it. You got two bonuses out of Branch Rickey? Then he turned to the TV camera looking out to the audience and said, folks, I thought two no-hitters were something great, but two bonuses from Branch Rickey beats that by a mile.
I think all of the old St. Louis Cardinals would agree with that.
Right. Yeah. So I started then in the 3I League, which was a Class B league, and I played the next full season there. I played a winter in Cuba in a winter league. Mr. Rickey insisted that I pitch in a winter league for experience. Then I came back, and that would have been the winter of 47. I came back in 48 in spring training, went to Fort Worth, Texas, where I played half a year and was called from up to the Dodgers in the middle of that season the first time.
That was 48.
48, right. Then I was up that year, back for a little bit the next spring, up again in 50, sent to Montreal for a couple months, their AAA farm in 1950, brought back by mid-year and then stayed the rest of my career in the big league.
And when you got up in 48, was DeRocher still there as manager, or had Shotten taken over?
It was right at the pivotal point. DeRocher had been manager of the club during my year at Fort Worth, Texas, and kept trying to get the Dodgers to bring me up. Mr. Rickey says he's too young, he's too green. The Dodgers had played a spring game that year in Fort Worth, and Robinson was in his second year. Came over to mm-hmm. me after the game. He says, "Young man, I don't know you, but I watched you pitch three innings today, and you can't stay in this league. You're going to be with us soon."
Ah.
That was a big boost to me because Jackie, of course, was a new name on the scene, the first black and so forth. But he looked me up after that game.
That's
what happened, DeRocher got in trouble with the commissioner. He passed a note or something to some underworld character right at a ballpark one day, and that, the looks of it was enough to cause a commissioner to suspend him.
Mm-hmm.
And that's when I came up.
Mm-hmm.
And I was brought up because of DeRocher. But by the time I was actually physically with the team, he had been suspended.
Yeah.
Bert Schotten was the interim manager. And Leo, who'd been one of my great boosters, and really had encouraged me, had now been suspended and then fired.
Mm-hmm.
And then immediately upon his release from his suspension, the Giants signed him.
Yeah.
So all of a sudden, Leo, my friend, is now the Giant manager. And I'm pitching in the Polo Grounds, the first time in my life in the Polo Grounds, and I'm a little nervous anyway, and Leo's coaching third base, and he is getting on me unmercifully. He's calling me some names I couldn't believe.
He could do it.
And I thought, this is my friend. I can't believe it. Well, he caused me to balk, and balked in a run. Well, that's what he was trying to do.
Sure.
And it took me a little while to figure out that Leo really didn't hate me, that he was he was such a competitor.
With Leo, nobody on the other side was a friend during the game. He could be a great friend off the field.
Right.
Well, fine. Now, what was your first game?
My first game was the day I joined the team. I joined the team in Pittsburgh, the 25th of July in 1948, and they put me in the bullpen.
Mm-hmm.
And nervous as I could be. But in the eighth inning, Hugh Casey had relieved and was trying to hold a two-run lead. He got into some trouble, and they brought me in mm-hmm. to relieve Hugh Casey.
Mm-hmm.
Of all things.
All right.
I struggled through the inning, got the side out finally. And in the meantime, the Pirates had taken a lead by a run or two. And so they used a pinch hitter for me in the top of the ninth, and mm-hmm. we scored three or four runs. And I got the win.
How about it?
So Bert shot and said, "Young man, you the good Lord is with you today." And I believe he was always with me. But
mm-hmm.
that was my first appearance in big leagues. And my second appearance was a one-inning stint 3 days later against the Cardinals, in which I came in. The game was 2-1, favor of the Cardinals. And I pitched the top of the ninth at home, got the side out. Went into the bottom of the ninth, we scored two runs. So I pitched two innings, had two wins.
That's great. That's
then great. I started against the Cubs, and my first start, and won the game.
Mm-hmm.
Then I had two additional starts against the Phillies, and won both those games, three complete games.
Yeah, you had three complete games
in
the first year.
So I was 5-0, and I couldn't believe it. But I had hurt my arm severely in my first start. Very ironic that I was pitching in the rain against the Cubs in New York. In the seventh inning, pitching to Bill Nicholson,
mm-hmm.
I pulled a muscle on my shoulder. I felt it was like a hot knife. I can put my finger right on the spot today because that spot healed and was retorn, healed and retorn, till I have a scar there.
Mm-hmm.
And that was a Achilles heel, I guess you'd say, to me my whole career. And Duke Snyder and I were roommates, and he can testify to the frustration I had in not ever knowing how that arm was going to react on any given day.
With the skills they have now, all kinds of surgery, could they have repaired that?
Questionable, but in those days, the climate was such that a rookie would not go near the trainer's room. If he did,
he was dead.
Oh, they'd give you a roast. And I went to Mr. Schotten in the second start. In other words, I hurt my arm against the Cubs in the seventh inning. Then I finished the game, but the next day I could hardly lift my arm,
mm-hmm.
and I was very reluctant to say anything.
Sure.
So I waited 3 or 4 days. They gave me another start. They were so need of pitching at that time. So they gave me a start 4 days later and against the Phillies, and I pitched to the sixth inning with tremendous discomfort and just almost sick in my stomach. It was bothering me so much. But my stuff was pretty good. I was ahead 1-0 in the sixth inning. And I finally told Mr. Shotton, very reluctantly, but I went to him on the bench and said, "Mr. Shotton, my arm's so sore. I pulled this thing today, and it gave me so." He looked at me in great surprise,
yeah,
and said, "Well, son, you're pitching a shutout. Now you go right ahead," he said. "And don't worry about any. If you get in a little trouble, we'll get somebody ready." Mm-hmm. Well, I wouldn't say any more. And I finished the game and beat the Phillies 2-1 in a complete game. But I must have done some real damage. So 4 days later, I started again. This time in Philadelphia, struggled as far as fielding, but had a shutout going to the ninth inning and ended up winning 8-1. But I must have done some real damage to the front of my shoulder and other things, because then I, from that point, through the next several years, well, in fact, until I quit in 59 in L.A.,
mm-hmm,
that place, that pull, gave me tremendous trouble. I always was very reluctant. I'm saying more about it now than I ever said when I was playing, because
mm-hmm,
I didn't want the reputation of being a sore-arm pitcher.
Right.
I just hated that connotation, but I couldn't help it.
That's right.
And so I just would go ahead. And besides, competition was so fierce.
Mm-hmm.
The Dodgers had 800 players under contract in those years, and all one-year contracts. And competition was fierce, not only to get to a spot, but to keep it. And pitching, of course, the Dodgers' pitching was always a little spotty. We did not have quite the caliber of pitching staff in depth.
That's right.
That we had in the other positions.
Mm-hmm.
And it was our, probably by comparison, one of our weaker, as far as depth.
Mm-hmm.
But we had some outstanding. Newcomb was an outstanding pitcher.
Mm-hmm.
Preacher Rowe. We had some outstanding people.
We did, but some of them for a short time. And,
but we couldn't get a combination of four starters that were consistent over a period of
yeah,
4 or 5 years.
Yeah.
We just couldn't.
We often had three, but not all
had three, and
Fitzsimmons for a while.
That was earlier.
Yeah.
But in my career, it was
yeah,
a little earlier. When I came up, Mr. Rickey was rebuilding the team after World War II.
Mm-hmm.
And so he accelerated youth, and all of us were moved up fast.
Yeah.
But anyway, I'm not complaining about it. I'm just saying the facts are
yeah,
I had this unfortunate injury.
Let me ask you this now. In your best year, percentage-wise, 53, when you were 20-6, was the arm feeling better that
yeah,
year?
There were stretches, but not. See,
never really left.
The funny thing about my best year was, by the All-Star game in 54, in 53, I was 5-4.
You're kidding.
At the All-Star break.
And so you were 15-1 thereafter.
Dressen took me fishing.
15-2.
15-2. Dressen took me fishing. He said, you're snake bit. He said, "You've pitched enough good ball games this first half that you should have won 8 or 10 ball games.
Yeah.
You get beat on one pitch, one play." And he said, "You know, you're snake bit." He said, "I'm gonna take you fishing and change your luck." So Charlie did. Took me upstate New York to a friend of his, and we fished. I came back the second half and was 15-2.
Yeah.
And so that is a typical of my career. I would have periods when I couldn't get loose or wasn't pitching well, and then I'd have some, I wouldn't say brilliant, but I had some stretches and some
mm-hmm,
days that were good, but I was not real consistent. And
let me inject this question. Newcomb was a great pitcher, but was he snake bitten in World Series play?
It's one of those unexplainable things that happen in sports.
Yeah.
I can't explain it any more than I can explain how some 210 hitter can hit a Hall of Fame pitcher better than
that's right,
than a Hall of Fame hitter can.
Yeah.
Those are the magic mystiques or whatever of baseball.
Absolutely.
Newcomb pitched one of the greatest games in the World Series that's been pitched and got beat 1-0.
Yeah, on a home run.
And then Don, who was a sensitive guy, even though he seemed loud and
mm-hmm,
boisterous, and Newcomb was really not. That was a come on in a way. Nuke was a very sensitive guy.
Kind of a cover up.
And being one of the early black players,
yeah,
and handling that on top of the pressures of a major league team, Don just had trouble handling that. Then when he got in the World Series, got beat on that at home run by Hendrick in 49. Pitched a tremendous game.
Yeah, sure.
Got him off on the wrong foot. He took a loss. Then he came back in other starts and just had those days that didn't match. And then Berra was his nemesis. And I always remember in Ebbets Field after a number of tries, Newcomb is getting another start. He is so determined now. And he's so determined he's going to not let Berra beat him. Mm-hmm. And he has good stuff, excellent stuff. And he strikes Berra out in a critical situation, but Campy dropped the ball. Nobody ever knows whether it was a foul tip or whether Roy's hand, which was bad in those days, he had a nerve problem in his left hand, and he'd had an operation on it, and it began to cause his hand to draw. Mm. And he couldn't use his left hand real well.
Mm-hmm.
And he drops third strikes occasionally.
Yeah.
Well, this critical pitch, and he struck Berra out. He had him.
Yeah.
And the ball popped out of Roy's glove, and the umpire says, foul ball.
Oh, golly.
The next pitch was over Berra's head, and he hit it into Bedford Avenue.
He could do that. Yeah.
And that's the day that Newcomb punched the parking attendant. I don't know if you remember that.
Yeah, I do. Yeah.
And that he was so frustrated.
Yeah.
It was like fate had him by the back of the neck and wouldn't let him go.
Yeah. You'd have to think
but
that.
That's one of those quirks that kept Newcomb from being recognized as one of the best pitchers in baseball during his time.
Right.
Well, he was recognized for that.
He
doesn't get the sustained accolades that he deserves because...
I think you're right.
That plus his personality, he's a little rough on the writers. and so they didn't see him in a favorable light always.
Yeah. Well, they didn't always see Ted Williams in a favorable light.
That's
either.
True. Yeah, true.
Now, you get into the World Series for the first time in 49. And that was the first game where Newt lost in the ninth inning, 1-0.
Right.
You think that influenced the whole team? Was that the turning point of the series right there?
Well, you remember what happened the second game when... Our starting pitcher was Preacher Rowe, and I believe against Lopat.
Tell me in a second.
That was another 1-0 ball game, but Rowe beat Lopat 1-0, and so that should have regained our.
It was Rashi.
It was Rashi started.
Yeah.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Okay. Rowe against Rashi, but Rowe pitched a shutout and beat the Yankees 1-0 back to back 1-0 games.
Isn't that something?
So, no, I wouldn't say that set the tone.
No.
We only won one game in that series.
Yeah, Newcomb didn't fare well in the fourth game.
Yeah.
And
I pitched a little relief in that game. I think the first man I faced in my World Series debut was Joe DiMaggio. I know he was either the first hitter or second.
Sixth inning, Erskine pitching, Lopat. No, Lopat popped to first, Rizzuto fly to right, Hendrick hit a long single, Berra popped second.
Okay, then it was the second inning.
Yeah, first man up was DiMaggio.
DiMaggio was the next inning.
Yeah.
He hit a towering infield fly ball. I never thought I ever saw a pop fly that high. And then Bobby Brown, they got some runs off of me in that second inning. I knew you remember that. Because Bobby Brown doubled, as I remember, somewhere in that game.
No, in that game, Carl, you only pitched the one inning.
That was it. Okay. Well, maybe later, somewhere.
Yeah.
Bobby Brown, now president of the American League, and
it was the next to the fifth game.
Fifth game. Okay.
Yeah.
He doubled. He often reminds me of that. That's why I remember it so well.
Doesn't let you forget, huh?
Right.
Well, all right. That was the first Dodger World Series since 1920, I think.
No, the Dodgers had been in the series
in
41.
Oh, that's right, in the 40s.
And again in 46.
Yeah, I take it back.
Right.
Okay, now 1950, you lost out in the pennant race by two games, but the decision was on the last day.
Decision was the last day, right, because the Phillies had a bad week. They had a seven-game lead going into the last week, and between the Giants and the Dodgers, that thing dwindles to the point where on the last day, we could have tied them.
Could have caught them, yeah.
And had them in the playoffs.
Mm-hmm. All right. What was your salary in when you came up?
Okay, when I first came up in 48, they had just instituted the minimum salary, minimum wage, was $5,000.
Yeah.
So I was paid on the basis of $5,000, although I wasn't there all year.
That's right.
The second year, I got $6,000.
Mm-hmm.
The third year, $7,000. The fourth year, $95,000. The fifth year, $12,500. So it took me 10 years, in the big, 5 years in the big leagues to reach $10,000.
Yeah. What was your highest?
In 53, when I won 20 and lost 6, then won a game in a series and had the series record. Bavese was the general manager, and I'm in the winter meetings because I was player representative in Atlanta. I was in a hotel lobby, and I walked through, and Hank Greenberg, who was general manager of Cleveland, was sitting with Bavese on a Davenport, and I walked over, they spoke to me, and Greenberg says to Bavese, "Well, Buzzy, I'll bet you $10 you won't give this boy what he wants this year." Now, who knows how they had it set up? I don't, I'm just a kid, you know, and here I am on a 20-6, led the leg and the whole thing.
Mm-hmm.
So Buzzy takes me back over. He says, "Oh, yeah, Carl, I don't have any trouble." And he said, Greenberg said, "No, I'll bet you $10 you don't give him what he wants." So I was making, I must have been making, I can't remember exactly, but it ended up...
Well, that was after your sixth season.
Sixth season. I'm a little vague on there, except I got an $18,000 raise. That was my raise, which put me to $28,500.
Mm-hmm.
Plus, I got an agreement with Buzzy to pay my family's spring training expenses.
Right.
I'd always take my family, rent a house. Duke Snyder and I shared a house because we couldn't afford one by ourselves, so we would share a house. And so I got the 18 plus. Buzzy took me around the corner and talked to me, and I wanted 30, and he says, "No way, Carl." He said, "Hey, I can't do that." And I said, "Well, that's what I want." So I said, "Go back and pay Greenberg the $10 because you're not going to sign me." And he said, no, we never had any trouble." He said. He said, "Let me tell you what. Let me do it this way. 28.5 is that's as high as I can go on your contract." He said, "Because we got other people and." He said, "We've not paid a pitcher that much yet."
Hmm.
Yeah, in those days, pitchers did not get paid
Play every day.
Right, that was the old theory. But anyway, 28.5, he says, "And let me do some things that I don't have to put in your contract, and you won't have to pay taxes and so forth. I'll pay your family's expenses of spring training." He said, "That's another $1,500 a year." And I said, "No, that's not for 1 year, Buzzy. If you put that in there, that's in there for good because we negotiated that as a part of this agreement." He said, "That's all right." He said, you bring him down, we'll take care of him." And then I said to him, "How about I'm getting my teeth fixed. I got some bad teeth, buddy. Mm-hmm. I think the club ought to take care of that. How would you like me to come up with a sore arm in the middle of the year because I got an abscess tooth?"
Right.
"Oh, God," he says, "how much is that going to be?" I said, "Well, I don't know. I'm doing so." He agreed. So I still have some gold inlays in my mouth that were part of my raise in 54.
That's interesting. Okay, we come to 51, a famous year.
Infamous year.
Yeah, you had a great season, and then you go up against the Giants. And Thompson beats Branco with a home run in the first game. Drove in the winning run, two-run homer.
That was a 3-1. That three was 3-1. Yeah, right. That Jim Hearn pitched that game against us in Ebbets Field.
And second game surprised me in a sense. Labine was a rookie.
Right.
Had been reliever as much as a starter, but he starts and shuts him out 10-0.
Well, you say the manager doesn't make much difference if you got the horses, but the manager has to make some choices, and one of the biggest decisions a manager ever has to make is who to start and when to take him out.
Exactly.
And that day, Labine and I, who were good friends, we were kids, grew up together with the Dodgers, and we're still very close friends. Clem and I rode together that day on the bus to the Polo Grounds.
Mm-hmm.
We met at Ebbets Field and we took a bus over. He had told us, dressing, one of you are going to start, but don't know which one.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know what tipped the balance, although I was fighting this arm problem always, as I had. And Dressen, I know, was weighing between, if he's okay, I'll take him. But if he's having his one of these bad days, or, you know, his arm's not loose, mm-hmm. I can't afford to gamble. I don't know what he was thinking. But at least when we got to the park, he picked Levine. Couldn't have made a better choice, because right. Clem had outstanding stuff. Yep. We got a lot of runs. And Rube Walker caught that game. Most people don't remember. Campy was hurt. Uh-huh. Campy had a sore back or something and did not catch the playoffs, or at least the second and third
game. Now, Campanella's in the first game, but Walker's in the second and third.
Yeah. Right. See, now, I'm recalling this. Yeah. I don't have any book in front of me, but I'm just remembering that Rube Walker hit a big, big home run and went on the roof of the Polo Ground.
Ooh.
So it was one of the few times you ever saw that happen.
Yeah.
But Levine's performance that day was just outstanding. And then in the third game, of course, Branca came back, who had pitched well the first game.
Oh, yeah.
He got beat, but we didn't get him any runs either.
All right. Let's get to that third game, which is one of the most sensational games in baseball history.
Right.
1-1 till the top of the eighth inning, and you get to Magley for three. And it looked like curtains for the Giants for sure. Newcomb sets them down 1-2-3 in the eighth.
In the eighth, two strikeouts.
Now, they tell me, or I read somewhere, that before the ninth started, Newcomb mentioned to Dressen on the bench, I may be losing it. That I don't know, I can't guarantee that. That's what I read somewhere. But anyway, he goes out and two singles in a row, Mueller hit the second one. And Irvin pops out, then Lachman doubles, drives in whoever that first one was, Pafko, I think.
Pafko's
been. No, yeah, I don't mean Pafko. I mean.
Might have been Marshall. Or
Dark.
Dark, yeah. Dark, okay.
And Mueller sprains his ankle badly going into third, and they take him out, put in pinch runner, and. Dressen comes out and removes Newcomb. Now, he had to make three decisions in that inning, and all of them were crucial in a sense. Should he have started Newcomb in the ninth inning? That's the first one. But on the basis of what he'd done up to then, you can't...
The key there was he struck out two hitters in the eighth.
Yeah.
That always remained the strong, pivotal point that everybody said, well, Dressen, you know, and everybody else said, yeah. Hey, Newcomb is coming on. He's not losing it.
Yeah. So you can't really argue with Chuck on that
right.
one.
Pretty tough.
Then he chose Branca. As I recall, Rowe and Levine were warming up.
No. Branca and Erskine were warming up.
Well, now, I thought that was true, but in some of these, someplace I read that
now,
Levine was warming up.
Not until Branca went in. Then Levine got up.
Well, right. That's too late.
Yeah.
All right.
But he, you remember, he just pitched nine innings.
That's right.
Before.
Anybody can pitch to one batter or two.
Well, it depends.
Yeah.
It depends. Sometimes
a reliever, but one who is a reliever probably should be able to, which he had been, even though he did pitch a complete game the day
right.
before. Anyway, then he comes in and faces Thompson, who had beat him in the first game, and Dressen chooses not to walk Thompson because that would put the winning
run on.
Yeah,
it'd be.
But Mays was after him and not having a good year, really, for Mays. I mean, he hadn't reached his peak and not a good series. But those decisions you can look back on and second guess. But anyway.
Well, what you have to have a lot of information, which fans and others always don't have.
That's right.
And the manager does have. And a lot of things go into the decision. For instance... I don't recall, and you have to go back and check it, but there was a period of time down the stretch when Newcomb pitched with 2 days rest.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
On a couple, three occasions.
I know that. He had pitched...
And he kept us in the race.
Four times in the last 10 days or
right,
something.
Right, and he had pitched, right. So Newcomb, knowing that, Dressen knowing that, had to be thinking about Newcomb being tired. And even though he'd pitched, and I don't recall who he struck out in the eighth, but, you know, it could have been situations where it wasn't all that dramatic, but he did strike out two guys. Also, the two base hits to open the inning, Darks and Mueller's, were both routine ground ball outs. Right. But they were, as they always said about Mandrake, they had the C and I.
Yeah.
And the old speculation, my good brother Bill Hodges, who was a fantastic fielder, didn't always go to his right as well, or in that case, I've heard some criticism that Gil didn't. Of course, he's playing near the line because of the extra base hit and so forth.
Yeah.
But that was a real routine ground ball at Mueller hit. But that's all, you know, second guess.
Yeah.
But the key move was then when Dressen finally decided to take Branca out or take Newcomb out. He called the bullpen and talked to Clyde Sucafor.
Mm-hmm.
Now Clyde, one of the outstanding gentlemen in baseball, was a very good baseball man, and what he told Dressen, no one could actually hear because he was down at the phone and I was on the mound, and Suki had been warming me up. He said something about Erskine's bouncing his curve, which I had that overhand curve and so forth.
Yeah, I've heard that or read that. And he said
Branca's throwing well. And Suki was always aware of my arm problem. And he was very sensitive about it, and he understood.
He didn't want to go to Rowe because he was left-handed.
And right. And Rowe wasn't throwing anyway. Rowe was not down.
Oh.
Rowe was not in the bullpen.
Oh, boy.
Now, if he was in the bullpen, he was there. Nobody paid attention or knew him. But I knew Preacher, a good friend of mine.
Yeah.
I do not recall Rowe being in the bullpen. Branca and I were up throwing first, and then when Branca was called in, Labine got up very stiff from the day before and started just a soft toss.
Yeah.
And so the first pitch Ralph threw to Thompson was right in his wheelhouse, exactly where we say no, don't pitch him, but it had good stuff on it.
Strike.
Second pitch was up and in, and he kind of muscled it.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, yeah. Yeah, right. Who is that? Tell him, ask him if I can call him back in just a very few minutes, okay? Yeah, that's fine. Good. So, any rate, he got the first pitch where he didn't want it, but he had really a good fastball. And Ralph had a very good fastball.
Yes, indeed.
And then the second pitch was where he should have had it, which was up and in. And Thompson fought it off and hit this sinking line drive that wouldn't have gone out of any other park in the league, but it did go out of the polo ground.
Yeah.
And Labine and I are standing on the mound watching between our throwing. We'd stop at each pitch and watch.
Yeah.
And I always remember Labine's comment was when he saw the ball, he says, "I just saw my wallet go over the fence."
Now you've been quoted as having made that remark.
One of us said it. I just remember being said, "There goes the wallet."
Something like, I never saw a fat wallet fly into the stands before like that.
So we saw, but you know, we went straight into the center field clubhouse, the old polo clubhouse.
Sure.
And we were the first to be in the clubhouse, Clem and I. And hurriedly, they're moving the TV cameras across from our side. Into the Giants side.
Yeah.
They were all set up for the victory celebration.
Sure.
Our side. The champagne cases
had to be open.
Were being carried through the door into the Giants side. And then when the door shut, it was really, I've never been in a tomb, but I imagine tomb was not much different than that heavy, heavy silence that we had in our side and the bedlam that was outside.
Yeah.
And then I watched our teammate, you know, I was seated where I watched each of our team members come in and looked at their faces and watched what they did. And it was a sense of history to me, saying to myself, this is one of the real dramatic things in baseball.
Absolutely.
And although I hate what happened, I sense that this is one of the moments.
That's right. You're so right.
I watched Dressen come in and rip his shirt off. He ripped all the buttons off his shirt.
I don't blame you.
And Robinson had his glove rolled up and he fired him in his locker. And different guys kicked a stool. There was hardly any words said.
Just actions.
Right. There was not a lot of screaming, yelling, cussing. Mm-hmm. And then Branca finally came in, and he sat down on the steps that were going up from the locker area into the trainer's room. Probably 8 or 10 steps went up to the trainer's room. Mm-hmm. Ralph was about midway up those steps and pitched forward with his hands down between his shoulders, down between his knees. Just, it looked like he's almost in a contorted position. Yeah. And that big number 13 was shining on his back. And all that just came back to me. But that was the scene, and it was just unbelievable.
And actually, Ralph was never the same pitcher thereafter.
It's hard to, they always said Herb's score was never the same mm-hmm. after he got hit. But other things enter in. Ralph had good years. He was like most of us. How long do you sustain being at your peak?
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if Ralph had already peaked when he was real young or what.
Mm-hmm.
But he pitched some good baseball after that, but he didn't ever have any of his best years after that.
Yeah. Now, Koufax was up by that time, wasn't he?
No.
No?
Koufax came in 55.
Oh, not till 55. Yeah, okay. All right, in 52 you made it back to first. In fact, if you had won that thing in 51, you would have been in about 5 years out of six or something
right.
like that.
Yeah, we had a stretch of... We had a stretch starting in 49.
Yeah.
We could have won maybe eight, nine pennants in a row.
Yeah, that's right. It was one of the
just
dynasties.
Bounce of the ball or some peculiar thing.
52, you were 14 and 6 yourself. And a great series.
Well, it wasn't so great. We didn't win it.
Well, that's right, but...
I got to start the second game in that series and had a peculiar accident just before the time to warm up. And I went in and pitched anyway, but I had injured my knee in junior high school in basketball. And I had a real tender place in the inside, but it never bothered me in baseball. But that day, I'm getting ready to start, it was drizzling rain. And I stepped up on a ladder in the clubhouse to look out of a small window just to see if it had stopped, because it was about 5 minutes to warm-up time. Mm-hmm. I was already had my glove, my jacket, the ball, everything.
Yeah.
And I stepped down off this ladder because it looked, appeared like it had slackened. And when I turned around, I hit my knee on the inside of my knee on a heater that was in the trainer's room. And I hit the corner of it right on this tender place in my knee.
Yeah.
I sat down in the trunk and was rubbing my knee, and I said, "Oh, Doc, God, I hit that right on it." And I passed out and fell face down on the floor. They revived me, got me up on a table, gave me some smelling salts. And about that time, Dressen walks in, and here's his starting pitcher.
Yeah.
Out cold. So they got me up, and I really was okay. I mean, I finally... And I didn't want to pass my first start in a big league in the World Series. So he was convinced I was okay, and I started against Rashi that day.
Mm-hmm.
And I had good stuff.
You went five innings,
And I came out, the score was like 4-2 or 3-1 or something like that.
It was 2-1.
2-1.
Yeah.
And then they ended up getting some more runs, and we lost to Rashi. But I didn't pitch too badly that day, but I didn't... I ended up taking a loss.
Yeah. But in the fifth game, you came back, pitched a complete game.
But what attracts my attention there is that Dressen had a lot of faith. He left you in there even though they got all five of their runs in one inning.
The Yankees were so tough. They were tough. But I started that game in Yankee Stadium and had good stuff, was in command. We had a 4-run lead, got to the fifth inning. Of course, you may have heard the story, and I won't drag it out, but I got a wire that day and read it in the clubhouse before the game from a friend that said, "Good luck on the fifth game of the World Series on this fifth day of October. Congratulations on your fifth wedding anniversary."
Hmm.
I thought, gee, that's interesting, and Red Barber read it and said, "Let me have it. I'm going to take it up to the booth. That's a little nice sight."
Mm-hmm.
So I forgot about it. But in the fifth inning, that game...
there were a couple squib hits, and then a single and two-run score, and then Mize comes up with two men on, and boom, hits one of the seats. And in a matter of a few minutes, my four-run lead disappears, and I'm one behind. Mm-hmm. And it just devastated me. So Dressen came to the mound and talked to me and left me in the game, to everybody's surprise.
Yeah.
Then from that moment, there was two out in the fifth, and Barra was the hitter. And Barra hit a fly ball to right. He hit it pretty well. It was kind of a semi-line drive, but it was an out. And from that, then I thought he was going to pinch hit for me. Mm-hmm. But he looked down the bench, and my turn to hit. He says, "You're it. You're it." So I hit and stayed in the game. From the time Dressen came to the mound after the home run by Mize, and the game went 11 innings.
Yep.
My roommate, Duke Snyder, singled in the tying run, I think, in the seventh.
In the seventh inning, you're right.
And then I think he scored the winning run in the 11th. But he was involved in scoring both runs, I remember.
Well, he doubles driving in the winning run.
Okay, so he drove it in. Okay.
Yep.
So Duke always hit well for me, being my good roommate.
He always hit well, period.
Period. But there were 19 consecutive Yankees went down in order from the
fifth.
Dressing came down to the 11th inning. And that was unbelievable.
Oh, sure.
And right in the middle of that string, Johnny Sane was a relief pitcher. Yul Blackwell started that game for the Yankees.
Mm-hmm.
And most people don't even remember him as a Yankee, but he was still pitching fairly well.
Yeah.
He started, but Sane came in the middle of the game. Sane was a good hitter. And somewhere along the middle of that 19 string, Sane hit a ground ball back a second, which Robinson fielded, but it was a tough play. And threw to first, and Passarella was the umpire, made a call, and it was a very controversial call, whether Robinson's throw beat Sane. And pictures later looked pretty much like that Sane beat the play.
Mm-hmm.
So Sane was really incensed by that, and then we went ahead to win, and the next day he grabbed me under the stands and he said, "You lucky so-and-so." He said, I don't understand how you could get lucky. You're lucky. I was safe a mile. He's giving me all this.
Yeah.
And I was a young guy. I didn't pop off a lot or anything, but finally he kind of irritated me, and I said, "Johnny, you know, Newcomb has a saying, what goes around comes around. Do you remember the game in 48 when Phil Macy got picked off second base,
true,
and you beat Feller 1-0.
Yeah.
Was Macy out or safe?"
He's safe. I mean, he was out.
He
no
was
question
out.
About it.
But he scored the winning run.
That's
he
right.
Sane to win 1-0. That shut Johnny up.
That cost Feller his only chance to win a World Series
game. That's right. So I said, you know, you got a lot of nerve getting on me after you won, beat Feller 1-0.
Yeah, Mel Harder told me, "I've got photos that show that he was cleanly out."
Right. No question.
Just like Dinkinger's call in the Kansas City-St. Louis series a year or so ago. In the ninth inning, you know, St. Louis would undoubtedly have won that thing, I think, undoubtedly.
Right. Well, Sane's base hit didn't involve any scoring play or anything, but he could have. Who knows?
Yeah. Well, let's see. In 53, you had your best year. You pitched the opening game of the series, didn't you?
Dressen told me that I was going to be his three-start pitcher in that series. If we go seven games, he said, you'll get three starts. I'm going to open you up in the stadium. And he did. Now, excuse me. We're talking about 53,
53.
Okay, so you opened me up in the stadium, and I had a bad first inning.
You did.
Gee whiz. Disappointing. So disappointing. And of all people, Billy Martin tripled with the bases loaded.
He was the kind of guy that would beat you when you didn't
think. And this made me sick. Well, anyway, the Yankees were tough, now. Let me tell you.
They always had
a great team.
Yeah.
And to beat those guys, it took this superhuman effort in the 11 innings, the first game, and then Dressen came to me after the first. We lost the first game, although I didn't suffer the loss.
No, that's right. Labine lost.
Anyway, he came to me and said, you've often come back as ironic as it seems, you've got arm trouble, but you sometimes come back with less rest than normal and do real well. He said, I want to start you in the third game.
He did.
So I was so happy to get a start again so quick that I made up my mind that I was going to pitch the first inning like there was no tomorrow and the second. And I didn't care about anything except the inning at hand. I was going to go all out.
Yep.
Well,
you did.
That game, I had outstanding stuff, excellent control, and I started mounting some strikeouts, which I wasn't keeping track of because Rashi was a formidable opponent.
Yes, sure.
And they scored a real cheap run off of me.
In the fifth.
Just two scratch infield hits. It got knocked down and could have even been made, but Gilliam had a chance on one, knocked it down, didn't make the play, and it was a tough play.
Yeah, reached on another one.
They weren't hit hard. They were just infield scratches. So then they scored, and so it's 1-1.
Mm-hmm.
Then we scored one again in the
sixth,
and it came back again. The only ball hit well that whole game was Gene Woodley. Hit a line drive single to center.
Yeah.
Was the only well-hit ball.
Yeah.
But they scratched out another run.
Yeah.
And
tied it.
Now it's tied 2-2. So I pitched the eighth, and then Campy. Campy was to be on Edward R. Murrow's television show that night.
Yeah.
The first one. It was going to be the initial show. But Edward R. Murrow had coached Roy on this live presentation that they were going to do on Campy that night. And he said, Roy, now this is my first show. The best thing you could do would be to hit a home run today and win the game. Or hit a home run tomorrow and win the game. You'll get my show off to a great start.
Right.
Well, Roy, in the bottom of the eighth inning, hit one of Rashi's few hanging pitches. He threw him a slider and it got inside.
Mm-hmm.
And Roy hit it in the seat to Nevisville.
Right.
And that gave us a 3-2 lead.
And then in the ninth, you got your 14th strikeout against?
Well, I pitched, they had a pinch hitter, Don Bolwig. I struck him out. And then they brought, that was tied the record.
Yeah.
And then they sent up my nemesis, one of the best hitters I ever faced, Johnny Mize.
Exactly.
And what I didn't know was that over on the bench, Mize had been getting on the Yankee players that day for chasing my curveball and not laying off my high fastball. And Mantle, who struck out four times, he was really on me. And so I didn't know any of this, but the Yankees have since told me that they were just irritated by the way Mize was
needling them.
Needling them. And then Big John, what a tough hitter.
I know it.
Tough hitter. He was a good ball and strike man, too. He didn't hit at bad pitches. He'd take close pitches for balls, but you had to throw him good pitches. When you did, he could hit it out in any direction. And just one of the toughest hitters in baseball. So now here's Big John, and I get two quick strikes on him with curveballs. And then tried to waste a pitch, and I almost made a mistake. I got a high fastball to John out over the plate. I'm glad it was up, and I'm glad it had good stuff on it, because he swung and just fouled it off, and he shook his head like that was it.
Yeah.
And then I came back with another good curveball, and John had a very poor swing. I never saw him swing that way. And it was strike three. So the guys on the Yankees say, well, John came back, they gave him the silent treatment. But that was unbelievable. Then
I was walking on the Notre Dame campus and heard a radio in some dormitory room say that you'd gotten your 14th strikeout, and I had been I remembered being on the campus walking when Howard Imke got his 13th strikeout.
Is that right?
29, yep.
One of my thrills was that I was asked to go on the Ed Sullivan Show, which was a big thing in those years.
Yep.
And Ed Sullivan, I was going to go to Marble Collegiate Church for my friend Dr. Peel on Sunday night.
Mm-hmm.
And Ed Sullivan sent word over he'd like me to be on the show. And I said, well, I'd like to, but unless I can be on real early. And he said, I'll put you on early. So I went over and just to be introduced from the audience.
Mm-hmm.
But a live show now in those days, they didn't take much liberties because they had to be right on time.
Yeah.
I stood up and he said, young man who pitched so-and-so yesterday or whatever. And finally, I just impromptu, he says, hey, come up here. You come up here, young man. He said, let me tell you something about this young man. The only way we could get him was to have him put on first, because he wants to go to Dr. Peel's Marble Collegiate Church tonight.
Good.
And gave Dr. Peel some plugs on national TV. But on my way back down the aisle, a hand came out and stopped me, and it was Connie Mack.
You're kidding.
And Mr. Mack was there, and he said he had this very strange voice in those later years of his life. And he talked way out loud like this. He said, young man, I want to congratulate you on one of the greatest games I ever saw pitched. And he said, of course, I was the manager who put Howard Emke in the lineup against the Cubs.
Sure.
And I remember the day I surprised everybody by starting Howard Emke.
For sure.
And so I thought that was one of the real bonuses to have Mr. Mack present and stop me and talk to me.
Absolutely. Yeah. Let's quickly now, just a few more things. What was the trouble with Carl Spooner? He started so brilliantly, and did he ruin his arm?
Carl Spooner had one of these fabulous arms that he had an easy delivery, and the ball just jumped, telescoped into the hitter. Just with a fabulous fastball. And when he started in the big leagues, he struck out, 27 or 28 guys in
two games. Yeah.
Well, that was right at the end of the season of 54.
Mm-hmm.
We did not win the pennant that year. The Giants won it. So the Dodgers had very little to ballyhoo about all winter, so King Carl Spooner was a hot number that they could talk about.
Yeah.
By the time we got to spring training, Spooner had been well-publicized, and we were in Miami playing our exhibition games in spring, and Spooner was to follow Padres.
Mm-hmm.
In a spring game in which the pitchers were only going to pitch three innings each.
Yeah.
So he was to follow Padres. Padres pitched the first two innings and came in and told Alston, he said, I'm a little tender, and this is my first outing.
Yeah.
I think maybe two is going to be enough for me today.
Huh.
So he sent word quickly to the bullpen to get Spooner ready because he was to be the second pitcher. And Carl got up to throw. We had three quick outs. We had a very fast inning.
Yeah.
Now they bring Spooner in.
And he's not ready. Yeah.
And this, of course, the announcer says, and now pitching for the Dodgers, King Carl Spooner, the strikeout rookie, and blah, blah. And when Spooner came in, he wanted to throw the ball right through the backstop. And he hurt his arm.
Yeah.
And unlike my injury, he never was able to throw again that way. The fortunate part about my arm was that there were times when I could, in fact, get my stuff back and could pitch.
Yeah.
But Spooner never was able to get that back.
That's a shame.
Tragic.
Yeah.
Tragic.
That's, there's so many cases of that sort. I mean, scores is a different sort of injury, but he had such a career ahead of him, apparently.
Yeah. Well, a lot of guys you never heard about had great chances. The Dodgers had so many. Rex Barney could have been one of the all-time pitchers and had arm trouble. Jack Banna.
Yeah, another.
Another one.
Yeah.
Young Dodger pitcher.
Yeah, let's quickly, in 55, you came back to win the pennant again. And it was the year because you, that time you didn't fool around. You took the series.
Well, we got off to a great start, got out in front of the league, stayed there all year. And then
tell me about your one home run.
Well, thank you for asking. I remember with Duke Snyder, he hit 40 about every year.
Yeah.
And I'd see Duke strike out three times and hit one in the seats and be the hero.
Mm-hmm.
And I used to kid him. I'd say, Duke, I'm telling you, I pitched, work hard 9 innings to win a game, sometimes no decision. You home run hitters, one swing and you turn the whole day around.
That's right.
I said, I'll make you a $10 bet. I'll bet you before my career is over, even I will hit a home run just to show you how easy it is. But I'll bet you never pitch a shutout. So we kidded about that. And then against the Cubs in New York, Sam Jones is pitching. We had a lead. We ended up winning the game 7-0. But somewhere in the middle of the game, Sam Jones, I can never figure this out, threw hard. Oh, which curveball. But he never threw me his curveball. He couldn't believe that he couldn't throw his fastball by me.
Mm-hmm.
I wasn't too bad a hitter. I wasn't a great hitter, but I used to just swing level and try to make contact. Well, I hit some base, some shots off of him before. I've had other base hits off of Sam Jones, but I hit a line drive to left center over the 376 mark, and the ball just jumped in stance. So I circled the bases, and I have a picture at home somebody took of me going into the dugout, and everybody in the whole picture, including people in the stand, are laughing. I mean, everybody got a big smile on their face. And that's just the way I felt.
Yeah. Roger Craig was with you that year.
Roger Craig, you bet. He came up, he and Don Besson came up the same day, pitched a doubleheader and pitched two complete games in one of them.
Can you beat that? That's probably
two minor league pitchers joined us the same day, both pitched, both won, complete games.
I doubt that that's been equaled.
That's the way I remember it.
Yeah. That series win had to be one of your best thrills, wasn't it?
Well, we were so frustrated having been in those series with the Yankees, and I was there 49, 52, 53, and now I'm 55. Of course, we got off to a poor start, as I remember, 55.
I'm not sure.
Seemed like we lost the first two games. They was 53, we lost the first two. At any rate, it went down to 7, as the Yankees always were. Blew the Yankees out. And I was very tense, although I was on the bench that day. Padres was pitching, and pitching well. And we got, I'll tell you where I thought the game turned around. Every bounce of the ball had always seemed to go for the Yankees.
Mm-hmm.
That's the way it always seemed. There was a play late in the game in which Rizzuto was sliding into third. I guess he was stealing third. And a batted ball hit him. And he was out. And I said, that's the thing that happens to us.
Yeah.
This may be different. And sure enough,
we were
able then to hang on, and or Padres was, pitched a brilliant game.
Yeah, Padres was the hero. What about Larson's perfect game?
Well, the seventh inning of that game, somebody on the bench says, you know, we haven't had a base runner yet. The first time I think any of us realized that there was a perfect game.
Mm-hmm.
And Magley had pitched very well at
Yes.
Allowed 5 hits, I think. And so we were not really into the no hit or the perfect game until about the last two innings, and then of course we just watched it finish up, and with disbelief, I saw where Dale Mitchell passed away just recently.
Right,
a fine person and an outstanding player.
True, and he's probably right that last pitch was a ball, but he shouldn't have taken it.
That's always going to be discussed. But
And Babe Pinelli is gone.
Babe Pinelli was his last call in the big leagues.
Yep.
He retired after that series. But, it wasn't his last call. It was his last call behind the plate, I think.
Yeah.
But Pinelli had been a good umpire and a fine person.
That's right. Yeah.
And whether it was a ball or strike at this point in time is rather incidental. But we thought at the time the ball was high outside. But one pitch, of course, that changes the game around many times.
Oh, yeah.
So there was no sour grapes over that.
No, there shouldn't
be. They respected the fact that Larson had done something unbelievable.
Well, now, one or two more questions. In 56, you had another 7-game series. Now, that's the one we're talking about with Larson pitching the perfect game.
Right.
And Newcomb had some more tough luck.
That's the series that I mentioned, Barra's foul tip, which Campy couldn't quite hold, which would have gotten him out of the inning, and he struck Barra out, gave Barra that little tiny glimpse of life,
and
he hit the next pitch, which was over his head, a ball, hit it into Bedford Avenue.
Yeah. How did you guys feel about the move to L.A.?
Well, you know, we were players, and we didn't feel much except we'd read in the paper and hear the rumors about the team possibly moving. We knew Mr. O'Malley was trying to get another stadium and had tried to, we went to Jersey City and played a few games at Roosevelt Stadium, and he tried to get the City Fathers to
to build him a, or allow a Villa Park in Brooklyn near the Long Island Railroad Terminal. And Robert Moses, as I understand it, at that time in New York, was opposed to it, and the city fathers did not permit it. So Mr. O'Malley then was romanced by Los Angeles, and we couldn't believe that we were going to move to L.A. Until it was really announced. But we knew something was going to happen because Ebbets Field was really an old park. There were changes in baseball. Mr. O'Malley was a very progressive thinker, and he wanted a fine modern stadium. And when he couldn't get it there, the pioneering spirit of being the first in the West Coast, people now, it's hard to remember, but baseball only went as far as St. Louis West.
That's right. Yeah.
And you only had eight teams in each league. So baseball needed expansion.
It did. And he seized the moment and conned Stoneham into going out there, and O'Malley took the plum and gave Stoneham a candlestick.
Well, nobody knew where the plum was exactly.
No,
in those
that's
days.
Right. That's
O'Malley, Mr. O'Malley got a site near the interchanges of all the freeways. Candlestick is 20 miles outside of San Francisco. L.A. weather is
twice
far
ahead.
Different than San Francisco for baseball. I don't know. It was a gamble for both of them, but
O'Malley's paid off.
I thought the location of the Giant team at Candlestick, 20 miles out of the city, was a very, very big disadvantage.
Yeah, they tell me that was a political move. And you didn't see last night's game on TV, did you?
No.
Cubs are playing in Candlestick, and they said the announcer said, and everybody agreed, that was the worst they had ever seen the wind in Candlestick.
Yeah.
It blew LaCosse's cap on the mound, and they picked it up against the right center field fence.
There you are.
And their uniforms are going like this all the time, the wind whipping them.
Right. That's not necessarily Candlestick. Yeah, that's any place in Frisco.
Yeah, that's
but
right.
Candlestick, for the fan to have to drive that far.
Yeah.
That inconvenient, I always thought was a big negative. Now, when the Giants are going good, people don't have too much trouble finding it.
Yeah, that's right.
But you got to sustain good attendance even in your mediocre years.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, in 59, you retired early in the season?
Mid-season, June 15th.
You just missed another World Series.
Well, I stayed on as a coach.
Did you?
But I was not eligible for the... Yeah, I got a share of the series money that year, and I got a World Series ring. But I was not an official member. I was off the playing roster and was in a coaching capacity. But my arm had reached a point where I could throw, but I couldn't rest between innings and come back.
Mm-hmm.
So
Larry Sherry was the hero that time.
Sherry was...
unexpectedly, I think.
When I retired on June the 15th, there were several players not on the roster who were the World Series heroes.
Mm-hmm.
Roger Craig won 11 games the balance of the season. He replaced me on the roster. They brought him up from the minors. And he won 11 and lost two or three.
Yeah.
Maury Wills had just come up.
Yeah.
And he hadn't learned to hit left-handed yet. And I pitched hours of batting practice with Maury Wills to get him through the ball left-handed. He was very strong in the series. Larry Sherry was in the minors.
Mm-hmm.
Frank Howard was in the minors.
Mm-hmm.
Those guys came up. They acquired Chuck Esigian somewhere along the way. I can't remember when he came.
He was important in the
and
series.
All the guys that won the series were not in spring training with us.
Yeah. Well, Duke hit a few in the series.
Well, I mean, excuse me.
Yeah.
We had other people.
Yeah, that's right.
But if you'll recall, one of the only times I ever remember that Duke Snider was taken out for a pinch hitter was in that series, and they put Chuck Esigian in. He had a home run.
Hit a home run. That's right. I knew he hit a home run as a pinch hitter. I didn't remember who he was.
I think you'll find it was Duke Snider.
Let me leave you this. That's about my. That's the publishers put out that flyer about.
Yeah, you sent me one of those. I think.
Oh, did I?
I think you did.
You already got it. Okay.
Well, maybe. Yeah.
Yeah. You got one. All right.
You bet.
You know, I appreciate this.
Carl, and I must tell you that I've talked to a lot of old-timers now, but I think you're the most articulate and interesting person I've talked with.
Walter, I probably talk too much and too much of detail. Engrossed. I felt so privileged to be selected. Here I'm just a little kid in Anderson, Indiana, and grow up, get picked out to go to New York, be on that team of great Hall of Fame players. But all the time I was there, I made friends with everybody. There are clubhouse people, bellboys around the league, special cops that work the ballparks.
Mm-hmm.
The people wouldn't know their names. There'd be no way. They're not visible. They're all a part of the game.
That's right.
Trainers that I got to know. Hotel managers. Mm-hmm. Just all kinds of people that are in the scene but are not in the headlines.
That's great.
And I, to this day, see and hear from neighbors in Brooklyn, where we live, Los Angeles. People will come through a city, and there'll be a hotel manager still in the business or something, and they'll sign in Anderson, Indiana. Oh, Carl, you know Carl? Yeah, Carl. I mean, that, to me, was one of the real beautiful dividends.
Right, right.
Of baseball.
Should be, but it isn't for everybody. It takes a person sensitive to that situation of all those other people to make that sort of move.
You know who was like that? Was Wade Hoyt. Did you ever know Wade Hoyt?
I corresponded with him, but he died before I got to talk to him.
Wade Hoyt was so grateful for all the contacts and the friends he had in baseball.
Yeah, I listened to him broadcast for years of the Reds games.
Right. And when I see a book and it has all of the greats in it, and somewhere in there, I'll get a mention or even maybe a picture. I had some good days.
You sure did.
But I didn't have a Hall of Fame career. But get to just be there and be a part of baseball I pinch myself.
So many of them told me that, and so many of the ones I talked with were from small towns.
Right.
And they all had that appreciation of having made it when they, as a kid, could hardly even dream of it.
Right. And then the fans, of course, make the whole thing. The people like yourself who are interested, who keep the games alive, to keep it right, and who do all the things to sustain it.
Yeah.
After my wife shakes her head and says, Carl, you pitched those games 30-some years. I can't believe people still want to talk about it.
Oh, yeah.
And I said, in some ways, they're more vivid now than when they happened.
They've mushroomed. So, and there's this spirit of nostalgia abroad in the country in these last 2, 3, 4 years.
Right. So I feel fortunate. And when guys tell me, Carl, they were real ball players in your day. You guys played for the love of the game. And you were great. I love to hear that.
That's
I don't believe it, but
I believe it.
I think today you've got a great group of young superstar talents. Now you got a few bad actors and anything, but generally the 600 plus major league players today are class individuals.
Yeah, I agree. Did you fellas feel that Roger Kahn did real justice to you and the boys this summer?
Well, there was some differences of opinion about the book. Because Roger wrote it from his own perspective and in his own field, which he should have.
Yeah.
And it was almost an autobiography work. Most of the guys appreciate that somebody captured that era, and that's what he did.
That's
and the Boys of Summer title was appropriate. And Roger was very impressed with me, but shouldn't have been. But I was in England last year, and I went to Westminster Abbey.
Good.
And in there is the grave of Dylan Thomas, the poet, whose line Roger picked out, saying, "The Boys of Summer."
Right.
I see the Boys of Summer in their ruin. I wrote Roger from England and said, I've visited the grave and felt a very special feeling about how all that fit together.
You should.
And Roger said, "Gee, that's for a dumb ball player, Carl, that was pretty good."
Did you leave baseball in 59?
I stayed to the end of the season.
Yeah.
And then, in fact, the final act of mine in baseball was to attend a victory party in Chicago at the end of the World Series, mm-hmm. where I went with the team and we had a big blowout celebrating the win over the White Sox.
Yep.
I told everybody goodbye right there.
Good.
And came straight down to Indiana.
When did you get into the banking business?
63. I came home in 1960. By 63, I had coached a little at the college local here, a local college, mm-hmm. Anderson College,
yeah.
and was selling insurance to make a living. And the new little bank, First National Bank, came from a community out in the county, moved into the county seat here in Anderson.
Mm-hmm.
It was a very small country bank, had come into this town, and asked me to serve on the board since they had no local directors.
Mm-hmm.
So I went on the board of the bank, and from that point on began to be more interested in the growth of the bank and development. And I was out on the street a lot, knew a lot of people, and promoted the bank. And so came inside 12 years ago or so as a full-time yep. officer. And
here you are.
So by another unbelievable set of events, 5 years ago, 4.5 years ago, the board talked to me about taking the presidency of the bank, and I said, well, you know, I really didn't have that necessarily as a goal. I don't know if that's really appropriate. And he said, no, we think it is, because in this community and so forth, I have represented the bank principally because we have a lot of out-of-town directors.
Yeah.
And so I said, well, if I fit the role and can handle the role, you'll have to be the judge of that.
Sure.
So I became president of the bank then about 4.5 years ago.
Great. My father was a banker.
Does he really?
Yeah.
Yeah, great.
From Texas.
Well,
yep.
we have a fine bank, and I had a meeting just before you came in with our team, mm-hmm. which I look at just the same way as I did the Dodgers. We have specialists at yep. every base.
I'm sure.
And without them, my performance wouldn't mean anything.
Yeah, that's right. You're like the manager.
So
yeah.
in baseball, I was a pitcher, started the game, and was a necessary part, but Hodges, oh, Robinson, yeah. Reese,
Ferrello,
Snyder,
yeah.
Campanella.
Oh, yeah, good old Campy.
Those guys yeah. made it for me.
Yeah. What's the population of Anderson now?
65,000.
Is it that large?
Yes.
Boy.
It's really shrunk a little bit during some last 7-8 years.
Yeah.
But
well,
it's 65.
That's you would rank in the top 10 in the state, wouldn't you?
Maybe not, but we'd be
up close.
One of the we're called a second class by size city,
uh-huh.
but Anderson is a strong General Motors town.
Yes, I see.
And we're
that.
In a strong farming community,
mm-hmm.
so we're kind of have a
yeah.
both sides of it.
Right. Thank you very much,
Walter. You're a
Carl,
pleasure to talk with you, and I appreciate your interest in baseball.
I wish we had 3 or 4 hours. We could go on. There are an awful lot of things you never get around to in an hour, but this has been wonderful. Thank you.
Thank you very much.